Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today, it's my pleasure to speak with our guest, Jeevana Haman. Jeevana has written a brand new book, really beautifully written, and just years and years of thoughtful experiences being a yoga teacher. It's called The Teacher's Guide to Accessible Yoga, and that came out in January of 2024. Some of the other things you may know Jeevana from is his other book called Accessible Yoga and Poses, Practices for Everybody, A Yoga Revolution. It's been 30 years that Jeevana has been teaching yoga and has been focused on welcoming all people to yoga and celebrating our individuality, our differences. And his work is really focused on dismantling ableism, which he goes into in this podcast, especially in the yoga world. He loves to look at that place where yoga and social justice intersect. So I think you'll really enjoy this podcast today. We talk about trauma-informed or trauma-sensitive yoga and what are the basic tenets of that. Why is that important? We talk about what does it mean to teach beginners, people who have not been doing a lot of yoga and maybe don't have as much interoceptive awareness, versus how do you teach people who have either been doing yoga a really long time, or for some reason they have a super in-tune navigating system to their body and they can feel every little thing. And Jeevana points out that a lot of people with chronic pain and chronic illness, maybe they haven't been doing yoga for a really long time, but they do have that really deep internal GPS system that helps them to feel every little thing. So we kind of tease that apart. We talk about ableism. We talk about positionality and the ethics of yoga and yoga therapy. And we talk about imposter syndrome and how it feels to have imposter syndrome and what we can do to work with ourselves, with our own practice. So just many, many gems, really beautiful things. And let's get right into the interview because I know that's why you've come. All right. Have a great day, everybody. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour, Season 7. We are so happy that you've been here on the journey with us for almost 2 years now, and we're looking at over 130,000 downloads. It has been a wonderful run together, and we are going to continue to provide excellent content. And this season, we want to go into the depths of the human experience and the human heart. So stay tuned. We're going to continue this journey together, and we look forward to seeing you for all of Season 7. Welcome, Jeevana. It's so nice to see you today.
Thank you. Hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm great. It sounds like you have some sniffles happening.
Yeah, a little bit. Not too bad, though. It just feels like finally it's happening. I've been hiding away for years, but now I'm back, I guess, back in the world, and it's challenging.
I found that, you know, I too have been hiding in my house for years, and now I've been back out in the world, and I'm getting like these little sore throats every few days, and I just feel my immune system trying to fight those little sore throats, and then I'm fine the next day.
Yeah, that's kind of what's happening, but it just makes me more aware of, you know, people who have chronic illness and other disabling conditions that really, I just feel like we need to be more careful for them, you know, so I'm fine.
I agree. I guess that's a whole nother podcast.
Yes.
Society's response to taking care of one another or lack thereof.
Exactly.
Well, today we are here to talk about your wonderful new book. It's called The Teacher's Guide to Accessible Yoga. And tell us, how did this book come about?
Well, I've told you before, I love writing. So for me, it's just a practice that I do regularly. I just always am writing something. And I had created a new manual for the 200-hour accessible yoga training I ran last year. And I realized that as I was writing that manual, that this is information that I'd love to share more broadly. And so I kind of used that as a template and then rewrote it with a more general approach around accessible yoga. And that's the book. And in a way, this book kind of contains most of the things that I share in my training. So it's basically like just sharing everything that I do with the world.
I think a lot of us go through this, that we want to really share our work broadly and widely. And then it's like, well, why would they come to the training if they can just get this book?
Right.
But I think it's a self-limiting belief. I mean, I really want to go through this because I think in the end, it doesn't happen that way. You actually get more people interested in your work. And I'd like to hear your explanation of how that happens. I have a theory too.
Yeah, I mean, well, my feeling about it is actually in my heart, I'm a teacher and I just want to teach. And so I find myself using every avenue available to me. I don't just myself to trainings. Even though I mostly make a living from doing that, I also share a ton of information on social media. I just give it away and have a ton of free programming, free webinars and stuff like that. And then writing also, I just give it all away in my writing. I mean, someone could pay for a book for whatever, 20 something dollars. And if they really are astute, you could read that book and not have to take a training with me. It's possible, but it's a different experience to be in person and different stuff happens in an in-person training. I do a lot of marketing, but I don't really think about it in a way, in a marketing way. You know what I mean? I just think about it. Marketing is sharing and teaching.
Exactly. And I want to follow up on what you said, that we can read something and it can go in on a cognitive level, and we can take a tip here or there. I wrote down a few words from the book as I was reading it, like, oh, I really want to remember that point. But I think until we go experience it with other people and watch even how you interact in the room when this comes up or that comes up, there's an energetic shift that takes place within each of us at a training. And I think it can even happen on Zoom also, that is just different than reading the information in a book.
Oh yeah. And it definitely, I think a book's a great way to get to know someone, and to see if you want to study with them. Because actually to be someone's student is a very almost intimate experience. It's like you're connecting with them and opening yourself to learn from them. And you have to have some relationship. In fact, that's in the book. But just that the teacher-student relationship, it's so central to what we're doing.
And so I read that it's about the teacher-student relationship, which I'd love to kind of unpack a little bit, because that's so hard when there's one jiva and there's 5,000 people that have read your book and been on your Facebook pages and been part of your community. How do you manage that intimacy? Is it a spiritual intimacy?
Oh my God, that's such a good question. Yeah, I think it is slightly different to put myself out on social media than the way I interact with someone in a classroom setting. And so in the book, I kind of try to cover that more of like the relationship that occurs within the context of a yoga class or a yoga therapy session, even. I try to kind of address that more. But it's true, I don't really talk about social media teaching and writing as teaching, even though they are. And I do think you're right that there is an intimacy there that's required. And so the main thing I think of when I share on social media is trying to be as honest and open as possible and still have boundaries, which I guess is similar to in the classroom, right? I mean, both are important, being open and also having boundaries. Boundaries are the key, actually.
Well, let's go there because, I think we get into this idea as yoga teachers that we're supposed to be spiritual and we're supposed to be all love and joy and make everybody feel good. And that actually doesn't work. I think it ends up hurting people because it's not sustainable. Boundaries are crossed, then feelings get hurt, then a blow up. It's like the boundaries are what keeps us in relationship.
That's true of all our relationships, actually. I mean, I've learned a lot from being a parent. Adult children now often don't act like adults, but they're my kids and I'm learning with them about that, right? How to have boundaries. But also in teaching, my students taught me over the years. I started as an AIDS activist and I started teaching yoga to share yoga directly with the HIV/AIDS community. And I had students who were very ill and died very soon, like right when I started teaching, that was happening. And so immediately I saw, though, the importance of boundaries, because what happened was I got really sucked into some of those relationships and it was very, very painful and really got burned out very quickly. And I was very young and kind of immature. But then I slowly saw that, first of all, I can love them completely, but I can't need anything from them. And I feel like that's what I started to see is that it is a one-way relationship. I'm there to serve them. Hopefully I'm getting paid. And so there is that exchange, like, of money. Or oftentimes I would get, it would be like a hospital program or a grant that would be paying me. But still, at least there's some energy exchange happening where I felt like I was getting what I need. And so feeling like you're getting paid correctly is important. Or something, and finding a way to fulfill your needs outside of that relationship is really important. Like having my husband, you know, I've been with him for 31 years. That relationship has really sustained me, you know, through a lot of this teaching, almost exact amount of time. So I think it's about, you know, looking at that relationship and wondering, what do I need from my students? Do I need them to like me? Do I need them to praise me? Do I need them to improve and like get better? Like, do I need to feel like I'm healing them? And that's what was happening in the beginning, is I felt like I had all these needs from my students. And then when I didn't get them, like, I wanted to fix them. I wanted to heal them, which was really based in ableism, to be honest, but I can talk about that later if you want. But when those needs weren't met, I started experiencing burnout. I think that's what burnout is when it's like giving, 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 and getting nothing back.
Yeah. With probably not great boundaries.
Exactly. I had no boundaries. So I learned the hard way, you know, for sure.
You know, I've started asking our mentors in the Optimal State Yoga Therapy program to not be texting with their students. And it's a real shock to them. They're like, what? How else am I going to schedule appointments? How else am I going to communicate? Would your therapist let you text them on a Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m.? Like, no. So it's a mindset shift, I think, too. And I'm not saying everybody has to adopt that, including you, Jeevana. I'm just giving them an example of, like, wow, when do we get our private time to recover as teachers? When do we get to say, no, it's not okay, so that we can hold that space for them and not have to ask them to meet our needs?
Yeah, I think that's so important. I talk about, you know, that's why we practice. I mean, doing our own practice isn't just because we're teaching it. Yeah, sure, you should be practicing what you teach, but really, I think finding ways to fulfill yourself and to fill your well are key. And boundaries are essential, like you said. Holding a boundary, like, don't text me, is a great boundary. Like, I don't accept texts that are around teaching. Or, well, I give a few examples in the book. I mean, I was thinking about a student asks you, do you want to get coffee after class when you're the teacher? You know, how do you respond to that? I mean, it's happened to me many times. You know, those examples in the book, all of them, all those scenarios happened to me, but I didn't always respond the way I do in the book. I'm like using...
None of us have, sadly.
Yeah, I'm using my 2020 hindsight in writing, but, you know, I've responded many ways to that question of like, do you want to have some relationship with me outside of this classroom? And sometimes I did. I mean, I became friends with some students over the years, and then I stopped considering them students, honestly. Like, they're no longer my student if they're my friend. But then I started to see again that boundaries are the key. I could be more effective as a teacher if I stayed only in that relationship. And so if I shifted to become their friend or their therapist, there's ethical concerns, right? That I'm working outside my scope of practice as well.
Yeah.
And also there's a big question that I put in there about the fact that often students conflate us with the teaching. So they find that, you know, they're having a positive experience through yoga and they think it's us individually giving it to them rather than the teachings themselves. And I think that's often abused, that confusion is abused by a lot of yoga teachers to fulfill their ego. And it's a trap for us. I've been there too. You know, like, I love getting that praise and being told that I'm like the most amazing teacher in the world, but it only expands my ego, which is, again, the opposite way I'm wanting to go in my practice, right? Like, yoga is about actually getting the ego in alignment with my spirit, not blowing it up.
Yeah. How does that, I mean, there's like a double-edged sword here. On one hand, the teachings have been around for 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years. And of course, they're brilliant and amazing. And they're coming through Jeevana. And it feels so good to both teacher and student. And there's this connection. So there's all that going on. But then there's also this awareness of what you call in the book, positionality. Right. So on one hand, you're not taking credit for those beautiful teachings, but you are taking responsibility for the safety of people in your classroom. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think it comes back to ethics again, like I mentioned. And I feel like that section of the book is maybe the most important, is understanding.
That's what I felt. I love
mean, I probably should just have written the whole book about that, but it just, I don't know if that would have
That's
sold.
another book in you.
Okay. Oh yeah, I'm already working on another one. But yeah, I mean, I think ethics, somewhere in the book, I say accessibility flows naturally from ethics. That's the key, is the ethical practice. And I think yoga gives us, I mean, pretty much every tradition has some form of ethics, but yogas are very clear. The yamas in particular, I think, are great guidelines for us. And I would say that if you want to teach or serve and do it well and accessibly, to follow, think about ahimsa. How am I coming into this space and not causing harm? And that being honest about who I am and understanding my preconceived ideas about people, the assumptions I make about them when I walk into this space, my own cultural conditioning, the more I understand about myself, the less harm I can cause.
That's it. We could stop
Yeah. And
the
okay.
podcast, but let's
Well, I
expand
was going to say, and satya too, that's satya, isn't it? Being honest, just
on
telling the truth. Like, this is who I am. This is where I come from. This is my background. I'm a white cisgendered, queer man. And so I have a lot of privilege, and I think I need to really be clear about that, because that's not everyone's experience.
Yeah,
And I'm
absolutely.
mostly able-bodied. I'm mostly non-disabled. So that's another big challenge, is really understanding that position that I hold, especially if I'm working with disabled students. So I think my internalized ableism is an act of ahimsa and satya, truth-telling and being honest with myself. And that's my practice. That's my work as a yoga teacher, and even more so as a yoga therapist, I would say, actually.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this is even more for yoga therapists, to be honest. I don't know how many yoga teachers are really facing these challenges.
I mean, I think both, but especially in yoga therapy, because of that strong emphasis on the one-on-one therapeutic relationship.
Exactly. And the more likelihood that you're working with disabled people or people who are having health challenges of some kind,
Yeah. So, how can people work on understanding their ableism? Because what I'm seeing in our yoga world is that the people who get this positionality and power dynamics and the fact that they do have a lot of privilege, they're all over it and they're studying it and they're working on it. And then there's this whole other group that has no clue what we're talking about and really has a lot of resistance to it. And in fact, says it doesn't exist. And there seems to be a little bit of a almost, maybe you've heard the term lateral violence. Have you heard that term? Where, how can we get people to do this work without committing lateral violence is my question.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do see some resistance. I noticed, for example, there was a Yoga Journal article. This is Black History Month, and they published an article about how do we get more Black men to practice yoga. And then the comments were shocking. They were very much around, this kind of spiritual bypassing around, like, yoga is about seeing that we're all the same, and everyone needs more yoga, not just Black men. And kind of this like denial of racism, actually. I mean, it was like jaw-dropping to me. And it's also, the yoga teachings are used to push that idea, this idea of, we're all one. And so then these differences don't matter. And I think it's just such a misunderstanding of the teachings. I don't know if there's an answer for how to address all these kinds of these isms, racism, ableism, homophobia, and sexism, and transphobia, and all that. I mean, it's all part of it. I think, to me, I see a lot of the answers in the yoga teachings. I really appreciate the more dualistic philosophy of the Yoga Sutras.
Me too.
Okay. Because I just feel like it's more comprehensible and livable. And even though, of course, everyone says the sutras is for monks, and I still feel like I can relate to that approach about separating these two things, right? Creation and spirit. When we confuse them, that's when we get into trouble. That's when suffering occurs, right? But Patanjali is talking really about disuniting or taking it, separating creation from spirit. And I feel like that's the answer here too. It's like, begin to truly see the part of me that is human and constantly changing and impermanent
And imperfect.
and imperfect, right? And really being okay with that, like accepting my kind of chaotic, difficult mind and body, and the fact that I'm always struggling and suffering and going through changes. And the clearer I see that, the more I can actually begin to see the truth that's behind that, which is that I have this eternal, immortal, unchanging spirit that's unaffected by anything that happens to me. I mean, that is, I think, what people are trying to touch on when they say those things. I think spiritual bypassing is kind of almost like a feeble effort to get to that place. But I think you have to go through a little more suffering first. You know what I mean? You have to go through the mud to get the lotus. And I think the mud is just the human challenges that we have. We can't deny our suffering in order to find perfection.
You know, I am so on board with you. And there's a lot of yoga nidra teachings out there that encourage that non-dual approach and kind of float off into the ether and be one with everything. And I created a yoga nidra program that's based on dualism. Like,
awesome.
We are in this body, we are suffering, and it's okay to be here. And we don't have to go up there all the time. And there can be a portion of your yoga nidra that you get to float up and observe, but there's got to be a heck of a lot of coming to terms with being human.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think the way through suffering is denial of suffering. Actually, I feel like yoga teachers get confused in two ways. One is that we think denying the suffering is the path, or we think it's some kind of like discipline, self-flagellation almost, like somehow forming this imperfect body mind into something perfect. And like you're saying, it's like just seeing it, you know, like this is who I am, just seeing the reality of it. Especially for me as I age, it's just, I can't avoid it. I mean,
right.
I'll be turning 57, you know, in a few months, and I'm doing fine, but it's so clear that my body is changing. I can't do what it used to do. And I mean, it does other things, but it's just, it's natural part of life, and I'm going to get old and die, you know? And I think that denial of death is maybe at the heart of this, to be honest, that yoga is being used to support that kind of, I think, yeah, just basic confusion about who we are, that the body and mind will die.
And, you know, I know you've talked a lot about this. I think it's so interesting how yoga has turned into this weapon that if you're not looking young and looking slender and having a flexible body and blah, 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 that somehow you didn't do your yoga well enough. That is hilarious, because what yoga is actually saying is the opposite of that.
It makes me laugh. Yeah, I know. I think it's changing, but I do think there's that subtle thread is still there, you know, that if you were practicing better, yeah, you would look better. You would be healthier. That's the ableism, right? That's the internalized ableism of yoga. It's like the confusion about yoga as creating a perfect physical body or physical being, as opposed to connection with spirit.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why in the book, I spend the first part talking about yoga philosophy, because I pray that teachers are studying it, but I don't think they are remembering it or always coming back to it. And then just, we get so lost in asana, and asana is so appealing and so amazing. I love asana, but it's also dangerous to get completely focused on the body as your spiritual practice. At the same time, that's what's so great about yoga, is that you can use the body in spiritual practice. I always say asana is what makes yoga accessible and inaccessible at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that we have a Patreon community? This community helps to support the Optimal State and the Yoga Therapy Hour production. It's not cheap to bring these episodes to you every single week, and we hope that you'll support us in giving you this great content every week. So head over to Patreon, and as you'll see, there are different tiers, but my favorite tier is the one that delivers yoga nidra to you on a regular basis, where you can just tune in on Patreon and download the yoga nidras that will help you sleep better, have less pain, manage your anxiety, help you come out of depression and burnout. So many great gifts on our Patreon page, and we'd love to have you join us over there. Thank you for your support. We really appreciate you.
And I do feel like our yoga community is shifting. If you think about in the 90s, it was all like power yoga, fill up an entire warehouse full of 200 people and go through with some jam and music. I mean, we've come a long way. Not that I can't be good for some things too, but that was like the holy grail of yoga. And now it's really, I don't know, at least the people I talk to, it has really shifted.
Oh yeah. I know. Sometimes I think I'm in a bubble, but you know, I reached out, even in this book, I talked to some more mainstream teachers, and you know, that was kind of my interest, was to really not just stay within the bubble of you know, what I think of as an accessible yoga community, which is so positive and so supportive and so clear about these messages. But then I wonder about, yeah, the rest of the yoga community. And so I guess this book, in a sense, is also an effort to speak to the rest of the community and share these teachings more broadly and hope that they're listening. But it's funny, I had an observation today. I had an interesting interaction with a yoga therapist who basically was telling me that they already have their tradition. Like, they already know what they're doing. They're not interested in learning about this, about my, basically what I'm teaching. And I was just thinking about that too, about how lineage and like this idea that we're being like, I don't know, we're well-trained in one tradition, that sometimes can limit us too. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I used to feel. Like, I only need to know this one way. And that's true. I mean, it's great to know one way, but it's so important to be open to constantly learning. I mean, I'm always learning and trying to, at least.
Yeah, I feel torn about that one because on one hand, to have a continuity within your system of how you're looking at this human and, you know, the lens through which you view them, I think there's something really important about not having a totally eclectic approach, that there's some threads that pull it all together. And of course, who wouldn't benefit from what you're talking about in here? This is something that is kind of separate and beyond that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Maybe not separate, but it can only help us be better humans and better teachers.
What I was feeling from this interaction was like, I think what happens, I talk about imposter syndrome a bit in the book, and there's this kind of sense that I'm never good enough and that I'll never learn enough and I'll never be good enough. So I shift my identity, my ego begins to be identified with the lineage, with the tradition. And then I become very attached to that. I'm protective of that rather than learning what I can from that tradition and then still being open to learning more. And I went through that because I was part of a guru lineage and I really felt that that was all I needed. Oh. That's what I was told. I mean, we were trained to believe that's all we needed. So I believed it. But then I started to realize, wow, you know, yoga is way more complex than that. Actually, there isn't one way. There's multiple ways and they're often contradictory. And so that's the thing with yoga. It's not one way. There's so many meandering paths in yoga that go to different places and such a complicated history and often contradictory. Now I've been teaching for almost 30 years. It feels like I just need to admit to what I don't know.
Yeah. I think though, can I just say this? You had the benefit of a cohesive philosophy for many years from which to then open up to other ideas. I think that's a gift, you know?
It is a gift, but I think part of that gift is the recognition that this is one approach, you know, that this is one perspective on it. Yeah, and that's not how I was trained. So, you know, I think I just know that there's still that happening within yoga, this idea that this is the way. I find that on social media that people correct me and sometimes I'm wrong, but sometimes it's like, well, that's not wrong. It's just, that's the way you were trained. Like, it doesn't mean it's right or wrong.
We can get very dogmatic about our teachings.
Exactly.
Yeah. Then we're losing clarity because we no longer have discernment because we're trying to protect this thing or defend this thing. I see it all the time. And you start to lack clarity because you're not open and you're not actually seeing what's in front of you. You're focused on, I got to protect this thing that they told me was the right way.
Yeah. And actually, I do think that affects our actual experience in the classroom, because I think the students feel that too. To me, it goes back to something I address in the book a lot, which is collaboration and creativity. Like you said, I mean, it's important that we understand the skills of yoga, like the tools that we're using as teachers or therapists. We need to know them well. At the same time, there needs to be that kind of spontaneous creative spark that occurs in the moment when you're with someone. That's when the most beautiful teaching has happened for me.
Yeah.
You know, and the most profound is when I'm actually conscious of this other person as an equal being and we're in relationship and I respond to something they do and they respond to something I do. And it's both ways. So it's been incredible. Yeah.
You're in this relationship. You're both human beings. You're equal human beings. And yet you have the responsibility for keeping the safety, at least in that container of that lesson. Like, obviously you can't be expected to be the safety protector of everyone at all times, right? On one level, you say we are equal. And on another level, you're taking total responsibility for the safety in that container?
I don't know if I take total responsibility.
Okay.
I think that I take responsibility, but I also give them responsibility. A lot of my teaching is actually reminding people that they are ultimately responsible for themselves. So maybe it's just an excuse, I don't know, but I really feel like part of my job is to remind people of their agency and the power that they have over their body and the choices they make. And so in every class that I teach, I always say, these are suggestions. If this doesn't work for you, find a different way or stop. So that's essential. Sometimes I call it like a disclaimer, and that's not the right word. And maybe it's just getting myself off the hook, but I actually think it's essential in terms of reminding really what we're doing here, right? Which is reminding people of that internal power that they already have. That's what we're trying to do in yoga, is like, remember who you are. Even in this relationship, in this process that we're about to go through of me, quote, teaching you yoga, I'm simply here to remind you of something that's already within you. And you can show me that. I mean, some of the best teaching experiences I've had are when students stop me or say no. And I would say that something I started doing in my trainings is encouraging people when they practice teaching with each other or practice yoga therapy to have the other, quote, student person say no. And I really suggest every teacher and yoga therapy person in training to have that experience. How do you respond when someone says no to you or they refuse to do what you ask?
Yeah. It's so funny because as a college professor for all those years, I'd have these dreams that I was telling like 25 students to do XYZ and that they just refused. And it was a recurring dream throughout my whole. But what do you do then? Do you grip down on control or do you soften into the experience and say,
I have almost the same dream.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I thought I shared in the book about this like recurring nightmare where I'm like in a shopping mall or some huge arena with just so many people that I'm trying to teach yoga, but it's just too many, too big, and no one's listening to me. That's the thing.
Right.
But I mean, that's a dream about my own imposter syndrome. That's the dream for me about my internal process. I tend towards shyness. So that's part of my ego searching for power. But that's not really what's happening in the classroom.
So what's really happening?
Well, what's happening is I take the seat of teacher and I talk about that. I mean, imposter syndrome, it's dangerous to go either way, right? You can't think that you're the worst or the best. Like to put yourself down or put yourself on a throne, either way, you're lost. And imposter syndrome is a kind of egoism too, right? It's all big ego. So it's about finding that middle path, of course, of being, I'm here to serve and to be, I think I call it a servant leader. I'm here to serve you. And service is ultimately what yoga is for, right? We practice so that we can be of service to others. And to be of service to others also serves us in the end.
That's right.
Right. The way to find peace and joy in life is through service. So honestly, the path of a yoga teacher is a blessed path because it means we allow ourselves to experience the process of serving. And it's so incredible. So we get to be in that position of service and be there for the student or client in a way that, you know, we have worked on ourselves enough to understand what we need. We have boundaries. And so we're there just in relationship with them in the moment, sharing what we can to support them without attachment, which is very challenging because we're human, right? And that comes up all the time. And also with, I don't know, like fun and joy and creativity. Like, honestly, that's what it comes to me. It's like a creative process.
It is.
Yeah.
Those are the best teachers, the ones that can have a plan, structure it, and then be willing to go with the creative flow of energy in the moment.
Yeah.
You can really feel that.
Yeah. And I think it takes time. So I would say for newer teachers or therapists, just to be patient with yourself. That's the other thing I say in the book is like, you can't ever be an experienced teacher if you're not a beginning teacher or beginner teacher. Give yourself a break. It's like, okay, it's okay to be new at something and to make mistakes. And I've made trillion mistakes teaching yoga. I mean, it's like countless mistakes.
Even now, as you grow, you know, you're on the cover of Yoga Journal and you're, you know, you've got a lot going on. I would hope that we and you could hold space for you to be imperfect as you figure out the landscape.
Yeah. Yeah, I was teaching on Tuesday and I said something and one of the students after said, you know, that really bothered me. I didn't like that you said blah, blah, blah. And this is why. And they were totally right. Like it was such an astute point. And I thought It's funny because it was like I had an intuitive feeling that maybe that wasn't a useful phrase or something that I said, but I said it anyway. And so I was like, it's just so great, you know, to be open. I mean, it's easy to be defensive. I think it's dangerous to, for me, for my ego to be completely attached to that success as a teacher and want people to like me. I think that's where the problems arise.
I'm reading a book called The Courage to Be Disliked.
I think that book.
Really, really good. So I'll read a couple pages at night and just meditate on that.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to switch gears a tiny bit. I know we don't have a whole lot of time left. And the part of the book that really just was heartfelt for me was section 3, where you're talking about helping people have choice, build personal agency, get consent from them, probably not do a lot of hands-on adjustments. But the thing that you started off with that was so fascinating to me, and I'm going to start, it's chapter 9, page 193. It's important for yoga teachers to, and all people to understand that a lack of bodily agency is very common after experiencing trauma. For teachers, the most important thing we can do is to create an environment and offer tools that can help bring back that sense of agency, to create a very choice-oriented space so that people have the agency to choose to do something or to not do something in your class. So the reason I found that's so interesting is, number one, recognizing if people are disembodied, technically, yeah, until they get embodied and start to connect again, are they even able to make a choice? Is that what we're there to help them feel safe during that time and then pass it over to them?
Yeah, I think you're bringing up such an important point. Was that actually a quote from Nitita Gesell? She's incredible. She's an incredible teacher. I just want to...
Okay, so it went all the way to the second page.
Yes, Nitita, she's incredible. So I just wanted to, you know, make sure to highlight her name and her work. She's an amazing teacher and offers, actually has a great book out, Embodied Self-Awakening is her book, which is really great. Yeah. And she also talks about race-based trauma, which is really at the heart of her work as well. But I think you bring up a good point, which I do try to address there, which is really a question to me of trauma-informed and trauma-sensitive teaching. And I think some confusion that occurs there in my experience, which is that I've done some training with other teachers around trauma-sensitive and trauma-informed teaching. And I mostly I adore them and like love what almost all the work I see happening. But I do think this one piece is often lost that you've touched on. And it's not just people who even recognize that they've had trauma, but for most new students, I find that it's hard for them to make a lot of choices about what they want or what's best for them. And as I explained throughout the book, it's like, to me, if you're going to look at what, quote, advanced yoga is, and I even hate to use that binary term of advanced or beginner, but what that might look like is someone who's more sensitive to what they need or their inner world, right? Increased interoception, for example, might be considered advanced in my mind, right? That tends to come through longer periods of practice. So for people who've had trauma or for new students, they don't necessarily have that. Some do automatically. Some people just naturally know themselves. People who have chronic illness and chronic pain in particular, I think have increased interoceptive abilities. And so already advanced in my book.
Right.
But I do think that some kinds of trauma do turn us away from our inner world and because it's too painful. So what I question is the way we use invitational language when we're teaching, because that's what almost all trauma trainings tell us to do. And invitational language, I think, is a great idea in concept, but I don't think it necessarily works in reality. Because what I've found, I don't know what you think, but I've found most newer students or people with trauma that I've worked with just need very precise, clear, and simple instruction. And the more I question them and push them, the more challenging it can be. And it can actually create, I think, can trigger people's trauma or just create anxiety if they're constantly being questioned. And so sometimes invitational language, I think it can be done well where it's subtle, but sometimes it's overbearing. And it's like every single sentence is a question.
The reason I relate to this so much is because I taught college students for a couple of decades. And literally, if I used too much invitational language and gave too many choices and you can do this, they didn't know what to do. They were waiting for someone to tell them what to do. So I figured out that in the first 3 weeks, I had to be really concrete. Lift your arm. I tell them if something doesn't feel good, don't do it. But like, now take the block between your two hands. And so we'd go there. And then over time, that agency began to be turned over to them. But we had 15 weeks together to work through that process of, I'm going to help keep you safe. But then eventually the goal is you keep you safe.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, I think you're doing exactly what I'm suggesting, which is to create a framework of it. Like, the framework is giving people agency and giving them the reminder. I called it a disclaimer before, but it's really that reminder of their own agency that needs to happen in every class towards the beginning and maybe a couple times through the class. Remember, if you don't want to do this, you know, don't do it. If it doesn't feel right, stop. These kind of little reminders are great. It doesn't have to be every single practice.
You're right.
Although when I get to subtle practice, like the more powerful ones, I would call them more powerful ones, I do think it needs to come up again. Like before pranayama, before meditation, I think giving people an out, giving them an option is really, really important. And what I tend to do is give just two options. Usually when I'm teaching, usually I would just give a chair and a mat option, but it could be, if it's a chair class, it might be two ways to do this or just one. Like you said, I think just very simple is best. Simple is always best. It shouldn't be put out there as the only way. You have an understanding. What I talk about in the book is that each practice exists on a spectrum of possibility, and that each aspect of that spectrum, every location on that spectrum is equal. Now, when I talk about a rainbow, like, it's not like red is better than yellow or blue. They're just different. And so if I do a tree pose, actually in the book, I talk about cobra pose, and I offer 20 variations of cobra that you could find. And they vary from, you know, traditional quote, you know, mat practice to sitting in a chair or lying in bed or standing at a wall or just imagining it in the mind. Each of those in my mind are equal. I don't think we have that sense in the yoga community, at least in the teacher community, that they're equal.
Yeah.
Any version of this practice is equal. And so I'm going to give you one idea of how you can do it. But if you do it a different way, that's fine. As long as you're safe.
Yeah.
You know, and I can watch you and try to keep you safe. But I don't know, like, just to let go of this idea of what it, quote, advanced yoga is, and this idea of more intense is always better.
I think we've come so far with that.
Yes.
I also want to go back to something you've said. And I know a lot of, if you will, leaders in quotes in the yoga and yoga therapy worlds are looking at what does it mean to be trauma informed versus trauma sensitive. Do you have thoughts about that?
I mean, I don't think there's a clear definition to me of one versus the other. I like trauma sensitive because I like the idea of being sensitive to other people's experience. And this, to me, sensitive gives this feeling of like in relationship and maybe responsive to. So I really appreciate that.
I agree.
But I'm not sure they're really different things. I think it's just different words for similar things. And, you know, just different words have different meanings. To be honest, I think the whole conversation around trauma is still young. I just think that we're still just beginning to understand what that even means. And I actually think the yoga community is pretty far ahead on that conversation culturally. Like, I don't think culturally we've really gotten clear on what it means to have trauma and the amount of trauma that people have, especially marginalized communities like race-based trauma. Or for myself as a queer person, like the trauma I experienced growing up being queer, it's just like there's certain things I never hear that talked about and understood in a clear way. So I just feel like that's a conversation that's definitely ongoing. What I think is great about yoga, of course, is that it clearly addresses, it clearly helps to work with the nervous system and to kind of shift our experience of that. You know, one of the most beautiful things we can offer.
I appreciate what you just said, because it's really tricky, because on one hand, talk therapy with a licensed healthcare practitioner can be so helpful and get great results. And then other times for people who, for whatever reason, have put these feelings and emotions down into their bodies, yoga and yoga therapy tends to bring it to the surface.
Yeah.
And then we ask them to go back to the licensed healthcare practitioner.
Exactly.
It's a hard one.
Yeah. No, I think they work really well together. The benefit I've seen is when you have both, when you have like a supportive, either a personal therapist or even a group. Like, I've worked with communities who have like a, I'll come and teach the yoga portion. They also have kind of group therapy going on at the same time. And I think that is a beautiful combination.
I think that's the future.
I think so too, actually. I do think group therapy of some kind mixed with some physical practices that focus on nervous system regulation, like yoga, I think is such a powerful combination. Well, both things could happen in group potentially, but I think the community experience is also a key there, because trauma often is so isolating. You know, we talk a lot about isolation, or at least there's some consciousness around it in the medical world right now around the dangers of isolation. But I think there is a direct relationship in my mind, at least, between trauma and isolation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yoga teachers, we can help that. We can bring people together.
Absolutely. In an embodied way, I think that's really the big difference in what we do. Okay, so what I'd like to finish with is, what is it about this book that we haven't talked about yet that is really important for you to convey to people? What do you want them to read this book and feel like, okay, I get that?
I mean, you've asked me so many things that I think connect to the heart of this book around ethics, as I mentioned, maybe still comes out to me as the number one thing. Creativity, collaborative relationship. I think that maybe is the most important thing, understanding our relationships with our students and clients better. What I really hope is that yoga teachers and yoga therapists have support for themselves. The title of the book was almost a yoga teacher's companion. Like, I want this book to be a support for the people out there who are doing amazing work. And I want to just say to any yoga teachers or therapists that are listening, like, thank you, you know, for what you do. I just am so grateful for the healing that's happening. And I think it happens so often, like, in private. We don't know, you know, what's going on in these small classes or in private sessions that people are having. Like, transformation is happening. And I think so many people just don't get invited onto a podcast like I do. I'm so lucky that I get to talk publicly about this stuff, but I just know that there are so many people around the world doing incredible things. And so I feel gratitude for that. And so I want to thank them.
Yeah. Thanks for that reminder that every seed planted is a seed shared. It's not to put too much importance on our work, but also say, yeah, we can do good work in this world and feel good about that.
Oh, yeah. I think it's really important. It's just, that's what yoga is. It's transformation. And it's just so, so powerful. So yeah, I'm grateful to you also, you know, doing such an amazing job. Thank you, Amy. I love what you share. And I feel like you bring not only a clear kind of analytical approach, just, you're so smart. I just feel it in your questions and when I read from you and watch you do, but you seem sensitive too, like so open to learning. So I just, very grateful to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, where can we find this book? Because I heard a secret that you self-published it, which I love. Thinking of every cent going to you and your family and your organization.
Well, not every cent, because of course, whoever's selling the book is also making money, but self-publishing is more than the royalties I would get from my previous books. So you can get the book anywhere, honestly, like anywhere you get the book is fine. I get paid, whether it's through bookshop.org. I love that place because they support independent booksellers around the world. I can share a link with you if you want, but also even Amazon. I mean, for all the horrible things they do, they at least have a platform for self-publishers, which I appreciate, but the book is distributed hopefully widely. That was my goal. It should be available wherever you get books. And I would just say the self-publishing and regular publishing are both completely valid and really exciting ways to, you know, write and publish books.
And can they go to your website, jeevanahaman.com?
Yes, you can go to my website and there are links there for different places, but I link back to bookshop.org and even Amazon, I think, just because it's so easy for people. I mean, that's again, a whole nother conversation. If you want to have some time around publishing, I've just learned so much now.
I certainly want to have that conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. We'll come back another time, but for now, bookshop.org, amazon.com. And just feeling really happy for you that you were able to self-publish. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you to Jeevana for being with us today. And I just want to spend a moment showing you who are watching on YouTube, because, you know, this is an audio podcast on all the major audio platforms, but it's also a video podcast on YouTube. So if anyone wants to share these teachings in the video format, You always can. So here is where we can get the book, Jivana Heman Online, JivanaHeyman.com. And that's where you can find this self-published book, which I'm so happy that he's done that. And then also we have the accessibleyogaschool.com, which also has all the different trainings that are coming up, some live in person, some online, some on demand, meaning you can watch trainings that they have given before, but just a beautiful offering. And the newest one, Yoga for Spoonies, Exploring Practice and Teaching for Chronic Illness. Jivana is out of Santa Barbara. So that's also a really nice place to go hang out and have a yoga retreat. So thank you everyone for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We know you are so important to us and we thank you. And if you can give us a little rating on any of your favorite podcast platforms, we really, really appreciate your support. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We want to remind you that you can always go over to YouTube and see the video versions of almost all the podcasts. However, we do reserve the most recent video production for our Patreon members. Our Patreon members help to support this podcast, and we'd love to invite you to be part of that community also. They get free gifts every week, yoga nidras, and all the newest content before it comes over to YouTube. So find us on Patreon. It's the Yoga Therapy Hour and Optimal State, and we'd love to have you support the show.
A special thank you to our team here at Optimal State. We are truly a global family. George Mantuan, one of our executive producers. Adam Satchel, senior media producer and sound engineer from the Philippines. Krishna Panchal, a producer from Canada. Modupe Abdullahi, who does the show notes and is an editor for us from Nigeria. And Peter Morley, who wrote and produced the music for this show, who lives in Australia. Find more about Peter's work at www.zenmusic.biz. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.